This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 258, Going Viral. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a chilly and cloudy and soon to be rainy, smelling like snowy Friday afternoon with my friend and co-host Michael Martin. Hey, Michael.
Hey there. I would almost call it a frosty day to go along with the chilly.
All I know is I stepped out to grab the mail between calls today, and it's like, you know that smell of snow?
Yeah.
It had a little bit of that going.
Just a tinge.
But I don't think it's going to happen.
No.
Because we've been hovering right in the just chilly cold, but not frozen temperature.
Chilly fresh?
We let it go.
Okay. Well,
on that note,
let's get this party started with something that is actually near and dear to our collective hearts and multiple hearts, I guess, if you're a fan of the show where
you're if you're an earthworm
or not, or you're an earthworm,
because they have five hearts.
So they have five?
Yes, if I remember my science correctly.
Huh. Well, I was just going after the doctor because I'm thinking about my friends in the UK today for a variety of reasons. And we're starting off with one of our friends in the UK, Ian Hughes, our friend ePred, who's written a really interesting post here that, Michael, you were the first one to say, hey, look at this. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. He actually posted this on LinkedIn earlier this week. He is, for those who don't follow this podcast on a weekly basis and know the ins and outs of the relationships of us and
as
friends,
et
cetera. There's a whole wiki on it somewhere, I'm sure. He's a former colleague of ours. I worked closely with him and started at the day job, and he's now an analyst for 451 Research. And Ian has done a great job over the years of looking at new technology and how, you know, kind of the namesake of our podcast, how gaming technology has been applied into industry and into the enterprise. And he has a new report out on the evolution and complexity of the games industry applied at the edge and in the cloud.
Yes.
So he talks about, you know, 5G, edge analytics, different types of networking that's going on because of the capabilities that's going on with 5G and how that aligns with a lot of stuff going on in gaming networks, et cetera. And the whole kind of shift into app stores and the app model for businesses. And so the basic premise, well, I won't say the basic premise, but some of the basic ideas here are around things like cloud computing. And you think of Google Stadia, right? Microsoft,
yes.
Can't remember what their cloud gaming platform is, it's a really interesting piece, and I'm looking forward to really going deep on this and maybe getting some time with Ian in the near future to chat about it in more detail. It would be cool if we could get him on the show maybe sometime soon to talk about this article.
I'm sure that it would, and we need to invite him. So Ian, if your ears are burning, you're about
consider
to get
that an invite.
Yeah. I've only had a chance to skim it, but he makes some really important points here about the importance of cloud computing as it relates to the game and gaming industry, the importance of edge, and how both of those things fit so nicely in with VR and AR, which is kind of one of our themes on this particular podcast, not just this episode, the whole thing. And the language that he uses here, I think, is exactly right. It AR has a lot of processing to understand the world around it in order to place digital artifacts in view, which is another very local slash edge processing task. So as 5G becomes more ubiquitous, more of the processing of the games are happening in the cloud. This opens up the door for much more to happen server side versus device side from an AR perspective. So I see that as a really intriguing concept that I hadn't thought about in those terms before, because I'm thinking mostly around ARKit and the way iOS operates with a lot of on-device activity. Do you have a thought on that too, Michael? Is that also seeming novel to you?
Well, I think the interesting part here is the way the technology has evolved to allow you to put the calculation where it needs to be, right? Yeah. This is the importance of edge. The importance is there are certain processing that must have minimal latency and the fastest amount, you know, the fastest response time, along with access to pretty much all the real-time data. Well, you want to do that as close to the data as possible, so that's edge. But there's other things that are much more tolerant of latencies or can handle much more abstracted data. And that's when you talk about what's the stuff that goes to the gateway, what's the stuff that goes up on the cloud, what's the stuff that goes offline into, you know, cold storage data, right? Things like building new machine learning models based off of historical data, right? You don't necessarily want your machine learning model to be constantly thrashing on the edge because, hey, I got a new data set or I got a new data point, right? And so when you look at the overall architecture of games, of VR, of AR, you want to do the processing where it makes the most sense based off of the data requirements and the latency requirements.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, I saw a lot of what Ian had written in his Google Stadia article kind of surfacing here too, right? Because that these are the experiences that when latency is noticeable, it destroys the experience, you know, and
destroy and them.
Well,
yeah, oh, sorry, different type of destroy. It's not that type of game.
Not in a good way. So, you know, taking this thought a little bit further, applying it to an AR use case, you had a really neat example of using our augmented reality to do a virtual. It's a my virtual model kind of thing dealing with makeup.
Yeah, I think we talked about this as something that would be coming about a year or two ago.
Yeah.
Evidently, Pinterest is now working with a set of lipstick designers to allow you to dynamically try on lipstick, right? So if you use the Pinterest app and you actually have the camera on, you can change your lipstick to match various different lipsticks that you could purchase, right? And so it's my virtual model. We've talked about them for, gosh, mm-hmm. a decade, more than a decade now, because they did some very early on dynamic models to do clothing trying on. But it was, I mean, it was cartoon, let's face
sure.
it. And as the processing and capability got better, you could start doing things like getting a 3D scan of your body and then doing, you know, the physics models to have the cloth drape exactly right. But that was still post-processing, right? It wasn't real time. It wasn't you wearing the outfit, right? There were some overlay examples that they did with, you know, a virtual mirror. But this is now getting to the point where they can understand based off of the camera, the lighting, the depth camera that's in a lot of cell phones nowadays, the actual shape of the lips, the outline of the lips, and then overlay the behavior of the makeup, in this case lipstick, to give you a true try-on. I think this is cool. I think we will see more and more of this if this takes off, and it's part of a purchase experience. So you could actually go into Pinterest, test it out with your skin tone, etc., and then click a button and buy.
Yeah, I like this a lot, and I just followed the link here too for the YouTube version of this, which they called Try On, and there was another article on this from August of last year.
Maybe that's the one that we originally saw and talked about.
It may have been. I don't remember that particularly, but may have. The thing that is super cool about this in my mind, though, is that the level of focus and energy that you need to be able to change the lip color is one that's a whole lot easier to model than it would be to change the drape of a fabric. And, you know, the way that a piece of clothing would you would wear it has so many different factors into it that are really tricky to go do. And we've talked about a couple of different instances of that particular thing as well.
If you notice in this particular model, she moves her head, but her lips do not change shape at all. They're almost unnatural the way she has them kind of frozen as she moves around. what would really impress me is if she would smile or, you know, open her mouth, or frown, or do something to change the shape of the lips. Because the point on clothing draping, I mean, that was something, again, 12 years ago, using, you know, significant horsepower of like a PS3, so a cell chip, to dynamically render the physics of all the polygons of a piece of cloth draped, right? The question is, you could probably take, you know, I'm wearing a t-shirt, and you could probably change the color of the t-shirt and maybe change a logo on the t-shirt, but I doubt you can very quickly in AR today take that t-shirt and turn it into a tuxedo shirt with, you know, the frills right around the collar and have it behave correctly. Right. There's so much in there that needs to break apart from a physics perspective. That's that needs to be resolved in order to make this real.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So if we pivot just a little bit, onto something else that we've talked about here for quite some time, and you and I have been involved in virtual reality experiences like this for quite some time, and we've seen some general examples of mixed reality. Spatial apparently has raised looks like $14 million more additional seed funding here for a VR/AR version of Zoom or Hangouts, and the first picture I think says it all.
I ought to go after him with a patent, right? I mean, this is exactly the article I wrote in 2008 on virtual co-location.
Yep, I remember it, and it was a doozy of an article because it predicted exactly this kind of thing. Yep.
I love it. I think this is so cool.
and when you think about the power of being able to bring people virtually together and have them be able to work with artifacts, move them around in a mixed reality type setting, it looks like the people in the picture are wearing HoloLens, aren't they?
Yeah, that does look like HoloLens.
Mm-hmm. So I could see where this is pretty cool. So up to $22 million. Whoa. And it looks like there might be snow coming down right now. How about that? Amazing.
Are you seeing snow?
I'm seeing some big old flakes of stuff, and it stopped making little splat sounds on the window, so could be.
Okay. Well, I don't see it here yet, but like I said, it smelled like it when I walked outside.
Yeah. And that's pretty darn cool. Love it. So interesting notion. You know, this is a way to bring people together and have them work together with them being far apart. Now, Zoom or Hangouts are not the only thing. NASA has been thinking about this kind of stuff, and we've seen other companies do the same sort of thing here too. Talk to me or share with the crowd here a little bit about what NASA is looking at doing in the VR AR space.
Yeah, I saw this one come across the feed. To be honest, I haven't gone deep on it, on the article. It was more one of those headline grabbers that I knew, oh, if I just had the time, I'm sure I'll really enjoy this. Sure. But NASA has for decades used simulators to provide an immersive environment for astronauts to do training. And what this is using VR and AR for data exploration, right? So in the example they talk about in the article is to animate the stellar neighborhood in order Ooh. To allow them to do star group classification, right? Mm-hmm. So in this case, they would get multiple scientists or researchers together, allow them all to go in the same animated virtual environment, and discuss star group classification where they currently are disagreeing on position, on data, right? So they're all seeing the same data from the same angles and able to rotate around, et cetera. Think of it as kind of a planetarium in VR, right? So that they can get researchers together and get their hands on the data together.
And apparently, according to the article, this Points Cloud VR tool is all available on GitHub, so you can play with it as well. And I would imagine it's another neat version of data visualization, kind of, you know, a planetarium in VR where you can spin it around, take a different point of view, probably take different time, you know, so show me what this looked like or probably projected looked like a million years ago or 10,000 years in the future or something like that.
Yeah, if you think about having the orbits defined or at least identified for all the points in the point cloud that you're standing up in the middle of virtually, then you would be able to add the dimension of time and spin it forward, spin it backwards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Super cool. Love that. All right. So speaking of super cool stuff, came across my feed this week an Apple Insider article talking about some new patent work that's coming forward from the Apple side of the equation. And this particular set of patents are really neat, where they're imagining an iPhone going into a dock on a MacBook and being part of the MacBook experience. Or, variation on the same theme, an iPad snapping in to a MacBook type keyboard experience where the screen would be, so that you're able now to have one device in a kind of a Voltron-esque way of bringing pieces together where the sum of the parts is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That's what I meant to say. And the visuals of this are pretty neat. I mean, there's already examples of iPad keyboard kind of connections.
Yeah, the what is it? The Bridge Plus that really tries to give you take an iPad Pro and put it onto a keyboard in such a way that it becomes a clamshell and really replaces your laptop with the constraints that you're still running iPad OS and not Mac OS in this case, right?
Right. Well, we don't know what operating system that might run based on the patent. This is more of a hardware.
Yeah, no. I was saying the Bridge keyboard does it that way, yeah. Right?
Right.
It tries to pretend it's a laptop, but it's still got the limitations. Matter of fact, they just released a new one with a trackpad on it.
Oh, really?
But the trackpad is limited by the behavior of
iOS.
The accessibility function in iOS that allows you to use a pointing device.
Or iPad OS. You've got to remember all that. Yeah. It's super interesting. You know what this reminded me of, Michael, was remember eons ago where there was a concept of having something, you know, the size of an external hard drive, like a small brick or something, and you would take that around with you and then plug it in to things, like keyboard, whatever, and then that was your computer device. You know,
and
well
by eons
cloud.
Ago, I can say 25 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I actually got to see a research experiment that was going on at a company that was exactly that, right? You would drop it into a dock, yeah. And that dock would have a keyboard and a monitor and a mouse, and you would just bring all your data along with you. But you know, we've gone well beyond that now with the the accessibility of data in the cloud, the horsepower of, you know, little tiny screens. But when I saw the patent information that you posted, it got me thinking back to something that I saw a couple of years ago. I was at the RSA conference in San Francisco, and Samsung was showing off their DeX, as they called it. And so what this allowed you to do was to take your Samsung Android device running DeX, that's D-E-X, and literally plug it into a monitor, or a monitor and a keyboard or a laptop or whatever, and it would give you a desktop experience, i.e. DeX, for that device on the larger display. So if you had a Galaxy phone and you plugged it into your MacBook and ran the DeX software, you would basically get Android in a window and run it like a desktop at that point. Or if you just plugged it directly into a monitor, it would give you the ability to have a full desktop experience on that monitor using your phone as the input controller, right? And so it really is kind of that hybrid experience that we saw 25 years ago brought to modern technology, and leveraging your data access on your mobile device, the horsepower of that mobile device nowadays, and the full app experience. So it's kind of that, again, that hybrid experience. The patents kind of imply a hybrid experience between a cellular device and a mobile desktop device, right?
Right.
Or a laptop. But this is coming at it almost exclusively from a software side, right? Not from a hardware side.
You know, for me, and I just filled out a survey earlier this week about my mobile experience and my work, you know, life mobile experience.
Me too.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
And there were a couple things that were like, you know, here's what is hampering me. You know, when the question was, what percentage of your work life can you handle on mobile device? I think I said somewhere 30, 40%, something like that. And part of that is that while you can plow through email or instant messaging, Slack, you know, these sort of things, you know, relatively efficiently on a mobile device, the content creation aspect always has some challenges around it. So opening up a deck and doing the appropriate drawing kind of stuff. Yes, if you had a pencil, crayon, you know, pick your favorite pointer and drawing device, that can certainly help. But I find it's still really difficult to create fluidly materials for presentations that then are shared with others off of a main computer. And that was my biggest challenge. So something like this could work when you think of the pointing device being a mobile trackpad or mobile mouse, mobile trackpad, keyboardy sort of thing, and you're just using a bigger display and then you're interacting with it through a keyboard. So the underlying horsepower could help you, and that would help with these pointing issues, I guess, the way I see it. Because I still do an awful lot of content creation and then ease of sharing, you know, like on video conferences, being able to share a desktop, get to various things fluidly, easily, demonstrate what it is I'm trying to convey, and then maybe update something on the fly with everybody else there. So,
yeah,
I talked myself around it.
Yeah, because it's interesting because I find myself being able to do more and more with my iPad. I mean, most mornings I spend like the first couple hours of the day just on my iPad, catching up on emails, dealing with Slack, reviewing charts and documents, etc. That works pretty well. And even joining, you know, conference calls and desktop shares with like WebEx, right?
Right.
And you can share the screen with WebEx on the iPad. And I believe I can actually share a document. I haven't had a chance to do that yet, but I think I can. I think you actually upload the document to a temporary space and you can walk people through a chart or a spreadsheet or a Word document, right? You know, things that you might be working on anyway as a collaborative effort.
Right.
You can also, and I've done this a lot in a kind of a co-creation place since, you know, you can do this with Google Docs. You can do this with iCloud Docs in the whole, you know, Apple suite. You can do this with Office 365 documents and actually just do it through a web portal and have multiple people all join together, right? And you can see their cursor move around. So a co-creation works on a mobile device. It's once you get into, I'll say, complex editing.
Right.
Right. Because I've created presentations from scratch on the iPad with fairly complex charts, right? With lots of graphics and stuff. And it's doable. It's not as fast as on the desktop, but it's doable. And I guess if it was, if I had started there instead of starting on a desktop experience or a laptop experience, I may be faster on the iPad.
Well, you've taken the time to kind of really dive in and say, can I have this be my replacement machine? Right.
No, I just like to learn. I don't want to replace my machine. I like my laptop, let me tell you. But I don't want to carry it around with me all the time, right? And I don't want to get it out and boot it up and connect it to, you know, some unknown, unsecure network that I have to run a VPN or anything. With my iPad, I bring my own data with me.
So I'm wondering, you know, maybe I need to play a little bit more with my remote keyboard, remote trackpad to see if that lets me do what I intend and want to do, because that might be the way to go. Well, we'll give it a go. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for the next exciting episode. Well, speaking of exciting stuff, you found an article on Inverse that our minds are going to be blown by Tesla.
Well, maybe. We don't know. All we know is that Elon Musk is telling us that the long-awaited battery day is going to happen in April. And for those of you that are not, you know, well aware of what is battery day and, you know, some of the other days that the Tesla company have had for a while, this is intended to be big news around batteries. Mm-hmm. So what we don't know is
it's not a day that we all go home and hug our batteries.
Well, it could be, or recycle them, which, by the way, everybody should recycle your used batteries. So,
yes.
You know, please do that. I keep mine, you know, off to the side so I can do that too. So be kind, recycle. But I'm really curious to see what this is too, because on a personal front, I would love to be in a spot where if batteries are now able to store more energy and can be produced at less cost, which I would hope would be the case here, that would be a great opportunity for me to put batteries in my home to help me power my home. So
yeah, and I know, I mean, Tesla's been doing, or I should say Elon Musk has been doing some great things with their solar platform. I think last I saw it was like almost $500 million in revenue now with their solar stuff. And a lot of that, I would assume, is tied into Powerwall, right? That battery storage option.
Which actually is a Tesla-branded thing. So it works in conjunction with the solar business too. But they are pretty expensive. And according to this article, and I hadn't been following it that closely, apparently the ramp up for the Model 3 push and to hit the production targets that they had for that particular vehicle took time, energy, and resource, batteries, away from Powerwall. So if this is, hey, the new Gigafactories plus are coming on stream, I've read somewhere about a new factory being spooled up in Germany, even for Tesla, in addition to the ones in China and elsewhere. This could bode well, and we'll be rapidly, because we've seen solar cost structures come down pretty rapidly. So the panels themselves, and it would be great for the batteries to be coming down too at just the right time when shoot, the planet really needs it.
Yeah, and you and I were talking before the show started. I saw this article, and my big thing is I just hope that this is about massive battery improvements.
Right.
And that I hoped it wasn't something that they would model after the Apple model, which was great battery improvement, so we cut the size of the battery so that the performance of the device stays the same. I personally would love great battery improvement to the point of where a battery-powered vehicle has 2 to 3 times the range of a gas-powered vehicle.
Right.
That's where I think the tables completely flip, right? I mean, right now I'm at, with my car, I get about 320, 340 miles before I need to tank up, which is about the range of a battery car right now with a Tesla. So,
yeah.
So from that perspective, they're about equal. It's just, it takes longer to charge on the battery. There's not as many charge stations. I can always get gas, et cetera. But if you get to the point where it's 2 to 3X, those other worries kind of disappear.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you knew this, Michael. I'm just looking at a tweet here from Mr. Musk, too. The factory in Germany is going to be in Berlin.
Yes. Yes, I did know that. I also saw that this week, because of the coronavirus stuff going on, the plant that was opened up in China was currently on hold or shut down temporarily until they get that under control.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on right now where factories and businesses are kind of work from home, everybody, past the Lunar New Year. And a lot of questions are coming on that. We'll definitely touch on that in a second here, too. But staying on the car topic for just a sec, there's another Tesla thing that I saw in Ars Technica, or maybe I didn't see it. It could have been just an image. with all of the work going on to help with automation and the ability for self-driving cars to become real, there is a notion of projecting information that really isn't there and having it get noticed and understood as real by the sensors on the car.
So, yeah, this was really interesting. And it's funny because I had just listened to one of the machine learning podcasts on data science that I listened to talking about how do you hack machine learning models, right?
Yep.
And provide, you know, there's an example that says, I'm trying to remember it now, but it's like you can show a picture of a gun that the model will recognize, you know, at 99.99% accuracy, that's a gun. But with certain paint changes, it's like, that's a tulip. It's like, no, that's obviously not a tulip. That
no,
is a gun.
No, it's not. Danger.
So I figured this is very similar in, you know, projecting light to spoof the visual identification of road hazard and road lanes and things of that nature.
Yeah, and this particular article, you know, does say a few alarmist but important type things here as well, saying that a teenager with a $400 drone could start to project things that aren't there and cause the autonomous vehicles to behave in ways that are not good, almost in the same way that teenagers is probably a bad term. So people with a bad intent might stand on an overpass and throw things at cars on the highway, right?
Yeah, so and I looked at this and I can understand the, you know, oh my God, what about this? And oh, fear factor. But what you have to consider in a safety critical system like a vehicle, a single input should not be the only thing used in validating the road conditions, right? So as one of the examples is, you know, projecting lines on the road that go into a wall, right?
Right.
You have a LiDAR system on the car, right? And a LiDAR system actually sends out lasers and uses that to identify things on the road, right? So it's not just the camera system that is the total and exclusive control of understanding the physical environment around the vehicle.
Yes. True. I'm reminded here a little bit of, oh gosh, now I'm forgetting the terminology, but remember from back in the day, eons ago, where there was subliminal advertising. Yes, there we go. That you would see in movies or commercials or whatever, right? So one of the example here of a potential, you know, misunderstanding or deliberate, you know, cause for misunderstanding is just flashing something up. So there's an image here of what appears to be a can of some sort of a beverage, you know, with a flip top, you know, cap piece to it here. And in the corner of it, there's 90, like the 90 kilometers an hour road speed limit sign. Mm-hmm. And the underlying text here is like, you know, on a digital billboard, you could insert something like this. And even though it might only be a visible for a fraction of a second, an AI could see it through the sensors and then take an action based on that sort of thing, too. So, again, I'm with you on the fear factor side of everything. This just is a way for the folks that are working on the code around how cars see, react, deal with the sensors, look for corroborating evidence, are all going to be more and more important as we go along and we have a higher degree of trust in how those vehicles, from a safety perspective and all the security that needs to be put in place from a safety perspective, do what they need to do.
Exactly. It's funny. The example you just gave was something that I was thinking about, or I was talking to somebody else earlier this week about that exact same example.
No way.
Yeah. and I'm trying to remember the context of the conversation, and I can't, so...
I used to be really into that stuff, and you know,
yes, subliminal advertisement, and talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, millions of dollars are invested in, you know, having people look like people are having sex in an ice cube, right? And that was going to make you buy this certain brandy, and it's like, okay, first off. If they're going to spend that much money because 2% of the population would subliminally pick up the image of that in the ice cube, right? And it took lots of extra money to make that, and then it's 2% of the 5% people that are going to buy the product in the first place. So you may have just spent more money on doing that image than there are people who will be infected to change the purchasing and buying behavior.
Yeah, true. But with large.
But yeah, numbers. I was into it too, really much in high school. Like, oh man, subliminal advertising.
See,
look, it's cool.
Right there.
I see it. Oh, you got to squint and turn your head this way.
So another thing that was really cool, at least I was like, wow, that's pretty neat, from Jalopnik was an article about autonomous vehicles that were suggesting that they don't need to be the same size as cars are today from a form factor. It's like, well, that's true because cars are the size they are today for A, the number of passengers that are in them, and B, because of the motor that's in them and where it is. So this particular author, whose name we can pronounce pretty easily, Matt Brown, thank you for that, says this is one of his half-baked ideas that other people have thought of before, so he doesn't take full credit for it. But it's like, you know, why do cars need to be as wide as they are? How about in an autonomous situation, you've got two half-width cars that could be driving right next to one another because of the sensors and intra-car communications? That'll all be awesome and good, and they just drive along and are managed. And it's like, could do that, right?
Exactly. I saw this article earlier this week, I think when you posted it into our Slack. And I was like, yeah. But that's people sitting behind each other. And you know, if you're in an autonomous car, you probably want to have a conversation. So why not put them next to each other or facing each other?
Well, that was his thing. So remember the campfire configuration
yes.
that we saw? So
yes.
That's in here somewhere too. Not campfire, but it's like, okay, you could be fighter jet oriented where, you know, you've got Goose sitting behind you, or you can turn the seat around and have a nice conversation. Although my wife said, well, you know, who wants to ride backwards?
I do. I like that.
Well, there are people on a lot of trains that do
you
that.
Know, you can
too.
Turn the beat around.
You gotta could have turn percussion. That beat around. Yeah. Well, yeah, you could have a tail gunner too. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to time. There's one last sort of big subject that you started with already on, which is coronavirus.
Yes.
In the news, it's everywhere. And there was one company here called Blue Dot Insights that came across my view of how and where you can track some of the interesting things around this. That took me very quickly, Michael, to the notion of where, remember the visualization, the data visualization that we had about how airplanes and air travel fly everywhere?
Yes.
So
that was a while back.
That was a while back. So here's my big thought on that. Right after 9/11, when all the flights in the United States were grounded for a period of time, provided a really interesting opportunity to study the impact of the lack of air travel on the ecology and health of the environment in the United States. And it was noticeable, right, when aircraft were not flying. Mm-hmm. I think we're finding ourselves right now at a state where there's a lot of concern around the virus and what needs to happen to have people be protected, be healthy, do the right things in the right way. But there are also some really interesting opportunities that are presenting themselves for a moment in time for researchers and for others to go, hey, let's study what's going on right now because things are changing very dramatically and for this reason. So there's a thought that struck me because I'm paying a lot of attention to what the World Health Organization is talking about and the way the virus is spreading, and other places have been mentioning the game around the virus that you and I both played quite a bit a while ago, too, years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And that's having a resurgence now because people are like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, something I can relate to now. My hope is that this will not be as bad as some of the models are predicting, but boy, it is a little scary, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, both the World Health Organization and the U.S. government have put, you know, significant restrictions in place. World Health, I think, is doing a level 4
right.
for the virus,
a global emergency. Yeah. Right.
And from a U.S. travel perspective, they're treating it the same as, you know, certain countries that have full travel bans, right?
Right.
So, yeah, this is scary stuff. And I heard a story this morning that it was actually accelerating faster than the SARS outbreak from a few years back.
Yes. Right?
It got to 10,000 people a lot faster than SARS did.
Exactly.
So, well, on that happy note, we are out of time, and we ask that you go to iTunes and rate us. By rating us, you'll make us more discoverable by other people, and we would love to, you know, increase our audience a little bit just so that we get more feedback from you on how we're doing, what we're doing, and what you would like to hear about here at gamesatwork.biz.
Absolutely. Love to hear from you and drop us those links. We'll be happy to chat about them. All right. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.
See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz, or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.